Betsy Vaughn now serves as the newly created Vice President for Addictions at the Council, at the National Council. And as you may know, the State Association of Addiction Services recently merged with the National Council for Behavioral Health. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it perfect that she's here? Like a round of applause. We just found out about this last week, and she was able, we talked to SAMHSA, and they talked to the council, and she arranged to come here. So we're deeply grateful. I just want to mention something about Becky, that she was previously a member of the founding board of the Georgia Association for the Prevention and Treatment of Substance Abuse in 1992 and became their first executive director in 94. Her responsibilities included training and advocacy at the local, state, and national level. Then in 2000, she served as president and CEO of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse. This is an advocacy role, and her work included the passage of many bills addressing substance use disorder solutions, as well as securing budget resources. She has served on numerous state and federal committees and panels. She's received her degrees from the University of Georgia and Georgia State University. I'm saying this because we know we're in good hands with the National Council she joined. So, and also good hands right now. So, it's up to you. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Take it away, Becky.
Take it away.
Take it away.
No, I was thrilled to be able to come and help out because I can't think of any better way to talk about integration than to talk about the integration that we're doing right now with the merger of SAS and the National Council for Behavioral Health. I'm a big believer in integration, not only between substance use disorder services and mental health services, but obviously we're really focused now on primary care. And that, to me, is the future. I am constantly asked, what is the future of addiction services? And it's integration, integration, integration. That's what we're all about. So I also, though, need to say that I am definitely not an expert on this, and I kind of chuckled when I saw that I had 15 minutes to talk about the purpose, design, and findings of this huge project going on. So we will go through this rather quickly. I do understand it because this has I've been part of this center, even at SAS, and now, of course, being at the National Council, we are doing even more. So from SAMHSA's perspective, and even though I'm not a SAMHSA employee, I've been following this quite a bit, we want to start with what do we know and what is SAMHSA basically doing about it. We do know a lot. This particular slide looks at what almost everybody in here already knows, and we have similar data to suggest the same thing for people with substance use disorders. But we know that people who have mental illness basically show these types of medical conditions at a much higher prevalence than people without mental illness, and we run into the same thing with substance use disorder. We also know that when there are no costly physical conditions in terms of what it costs for healthcare, it obviously goes up greatly when you have one costly physical condition, you have two costly physical conditions, and then three. And you'll see from this chart, blue are people who are engaged in mental health services, the green are people who are engaged in substance use disorder services, and then all other Medicaid beneficiaries. And you can tell it costs a lot more in healthcare costs for people who are not treated. We also know that SAMHSA's done an excellent job of talking about what recovery actually is, and they've identified four areas that we look at, and to me, these are the most important things that we talk about. Often in SUD services, we are constantly dinged on relapse rate, relapse rate, relapse rate, when in actuality, that's not what this is about. What it should be about is whether people have good health, whether they have a home, whether they have purposeful work, volunteer, whatever that is, and whether they have community relationships. That is really the basis of strong recovery. So PBHCI, obviously, primary behavioral integration, is what they have been looking at. Basically, the purpose of this whole project for SAMHSA is to establish projects that will coordinate and integrate services by actually co-locating primary and specialty care services in that community-based health setting. We have for many years done a lot of referral back and forth between primary care clinics and community behavioral health clinics. basically giving lots of room for people to get lost in between. And so by co-locating and integrating, obviously, we hope that will help. The goal of doing this is obviously to improve the physical health, particularly focused on adults with serious mental illness, and all the while continuing to look at the triple aim. And I'm sure nobody in here has ever heard of the triple aim, since every place I've been going since I've been here, all they're talking about is triple aim. And I actually talk a lot about triple aim too. It was very magnanimous when the ACA began to think that they could actually accomplish these three things. But there's a lot of really good stuff going on to do exactly that. At the same time, we were hoping with this project to eliminate the early mortality gap, reach people who do not normally access primary care, intervene before many of these comorbid issues and conditions develop or worsen, and a biggie, reduce that expensive ER use that so many of our patients utilize. Here's where we are. We're all over the country. You can see every single region has grantees, and all of these grantees are basically working, and you're going to hear from some of them today, but you can see kind of what's going on in each state, just to give you an idea. We're looking at the same health indicators that accountable care organizations are working on, because these are good indicators. Blood pressure, BMI, waist circumference, breath, lung capacity, all of these things are the important thing, and they are all monitored just like they would be in an accountable care organization. And we're talking about real people here. I really like this story because basically we have the example of an Asian woman with paranoid schizophrenia without health care for over 5 years. When she presented, she had very seriously uncontrolled diabetes and hypertension. Very little English, although she understood English a little better than she could speak it, but very limited resources. She basically, when she needed care, guess what? She went to the emergency room or some other 24-hour clinic. That was what she knew. I'm from Atlanta, and people referred to going to Grady Hospital as going to the Grady's, like it was somebody's house. That's just the way it was referred to. I'm going down to the Grady's. And so that is a part of, you know, sort of that normal thing. The intervention, basically that collaborative intervention with this woman, the efforts of a psychiatrist, a nurse, counselor, interpreter, physician, they got her enrolled. She was subsequently diagnosed, treated, began education on diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol, and as a result, she continued diabetes education. She has much better control of her diabetes, her high blood pressure, and that elevated cholesterol because she's now participating in diet, exercise, and medications. So what we found in the evaluation, sort of quite simply but yet very effective, is that there was a clear reduced risk for cholesterol when people began to have these integrated services. A moderately reduced risk in diabetes and hypertension, and we need more research, more follow-through on things like obesity and smoking. And one of the reasons for that is because those are long-term issues that need long-term care. They are not something that can be diagnosed and turned around quickly. But we did see significant results in the cholesterol, diabetes, and hypertension. So the Center for Integrated Health Solutions that is located at the National Council for Behavioral Health, we have learned some lessons along the way, and I don't have enough time to tell you all of them, but I do want to highlight a few things that have come out. The purpose of the center is basically twofold. We serve as a national training and TA center on that bi-directional integration of primary and behavioral health care, and related workforce development, because as everybody in this room knows, I don't have to tell you, we already have an extreme workforce shortage when it comes to behavioral health. Now that we're trying to add integration with primary care and everything that goes along with that, we have just created a perfect storm or a tsunami or whatever trite metaphor you want to use. We're in trouble. And so that is part of all that too. The other thing is we provide TA to the PBHCI grantees. We also provide TA to HRSA-funded entities. with the idea of addressing those health care needs of individuals with mental substance use and co-occurring disorders. So what are we looking at? We have heard from several of these entities that they kind of went from integration as just being a project they were working on to actually becoming a way of doing business. And that is our ultimate goal. And so when somebody actually says that out loud, it's one of the best things you want to hear, that it's like, oh, we just thought we were kind of doing this little project thing because we all are kind of project-oriented. So when they start talking about it now being a way of business, that's huge. We found that nurse care managers were extremely crucial. They were an important bridge to that successful integrated team functioning and treatment planning. Peers, also extremely important in supporting health and wellness interventions, ongoing recruitment, and that engagement with patients. Patient-level data, to get the data with the patient, not just their mental health status, but all of their patient-level status, was crucial also in that overall population health management. And the fact that we began to see mechanisms actually implemented and put in place, even if it was just hallway conversations or regular team huddles, those were the kind of mechanisms that we saw that brought lasting change in these agencies. Not to say we didn't have challenges and we don't continue to have challenges. Long-term engagement, and this is one of those things that we notice when in terms we're talking about weight loss, obesity, and tobacco cessation. You need long-term engagement to have an impact on those, and that's tough. I also don't have to tell any of you that either. It is hard to keep people engaged for a long time that really would address some of these things. Also, no surprise to anybody in here, federally qualified health center partnerships can range from a paper to fully embracing that client population, and I'm sure everybody has experienced everything a little bit in between. They are very personality-driven, just like most of everything else we do, and we've seen some incredibly successful ones. I have one of my providers who does SUD services in Grand Rapids took their time, but they finally did a full merger with the community mental health, with the federally qualified health center there. And they are now all working together, one electronic health record, one billing system, easy to do. And then I've got a great provider in Kansas who is swapping staff back and forth. So there are so many different models that can be very successful in meeting the needs of our patients. Nevertheless, there is not one model, and we're seeing it all over the map. Cross-training turned out to be kind of a challenge, and I'm always glad when somebody recognizes this, having spent 30 years in the SUD field, and by the way, I started when I was 12, that's why I look so young. But mental health and primary care staff, they need cross-training on the protocols of SUD treatment, particularly when we get into medication-assisted treatment. Those are whole new worlds for most of our folks. And that is not something that you just say, here's a book, read it, or here's a checklist, do it. So there does require some pretty significant cross-training there. And there is no doubt it is culture change. And I understand culture change. I have just merged with the National Council for Behavioral Health. I understand culture change. And it's tough. And primary care and behavioral health staff reinterpreting those clinical roles. It's like, oh, no, I thought I was in charge of that. No, I thought I was in charge of that. So these are things that are challenging but it's not something that can't be dealt with or overcome. So, but the whole context of that environment. And then we're always trying to figure out how to embed wellness services into billable services. Wellness we know is important, but it's not anything we can bill for. So when you're doing case management and you're talking to somebody, maybe you say, let's take a walk around the block while we're doing this. We're always looking for ways that we can pull in some of that stuff, even though we can't bill for it. So these are some of our challenges. We learned very quickly that leadership is obviously a big piece of whether this is going to work or not. Executive buy-in and engagement, setting those staff expectations, making sure the training is in place and not just saying, oh, well, they'll get it after a while. Continuous quality improvement, clinical issues, registries. Many of our folks are not used to using registries, and yet they are so important in terms of being able to track what's going on. Population management, patient, consumer-patient flow, all the clinical guidelines, evidence-based practices, there are so many that both sides don't know about and need to know about. So there's clinical issues. Operations, this will not happen in a vacuum. It does require changes in how to manage that conflict when it's not clear how we are relating in this case. Policies, procedure readjustments and adjustments, electronic health records, care coordinations, all of those things. Wellness, how do we activate individuals to support that self-management? These are chronic diseases that require self-management, and we have to engage the patient into understanding that they are ultimately responsible for managing that. Again, embedding wellness across the whole organization, evidence-based interventions. Financing, I'm sure many of you have run into all of the craziness in terms of billing and how do you cross bill and many of those kinds of things. Oh, I can't bill for that. You can bill for that. Oh, wait, well, then I guess I'll have to contract with you, or how are we going to pay that person? There's all those things. And I'm not trying to be the Pollyanna, even though I'm often accused of that, in saying that it's not a problem. It is a problem. It's tough, and it has to be dealt with. Community partnerships, sustainability strategies, and of course, again, if you didn't hear me say it the first time, I must say it again, all staff have to be trained. It is not something that just part of them doesn't know. Everybody in the organization requires training. And recruitment and retention are very big issues in our workforce. So briefly, just to let you know who we are as the National Council, we represent and support over 2,500 community-based organizations that provide mental health and substance use disorder services to about 8 million adults, children, and families. We are the national voice for legislation, regulations, practices that protect and expand access to adequately funded, get that adequately funded part, that's a big piece of us, as well as effective mental health and addiction services. So those are very important to us. They're what we focus on, and they're very important to the community-based organizations that we represent. This is the website for the Center for Integrated Health Solutions. There is a wealth of information there. If you haven't been there, take a minute and go check, because it is absolutely amazing how much is there. And I will basically close by reminding you that change is a part of what we do. And Margaret asked me earlier, she goes, you must be pretty good at change. And I'm like, yeah, I've had an 18-month pregnancy trying to get these two organizations together. But change is important. And I like to remind many of my SUD providers when they say, you know, Becky, can I just kind of stay the way I am? Maybe I won't take advantage of all these opportunities. And Peter Drucker said it better than I possibly could have. He said, no, you don't have to change, because basically survival's not mandatory. And that's what I kind of remind them of. No, you're fine. Just keep doing it the way you're doing it. We'll see how that does for you. But here's all our contact information. That website is at integration@samhsa.gov. You can find us even by telephone. That seems kind of remote and backwards these days, but people do still pick up the phone. And we basically are working with not only these grantees, but anybody can get an hour's worth of free TA under this contract. You can call and tell us what you're dealing with, and we have lots of resources we can help you. We have webinars. We have issue briefs. You can sign up for the newsletter at the website. There are many, many resources that are available to you. And I truly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk to you. And I'm actually looking forward to hearing more about these other projects. So thank you.